Of all the astonishing things that take place inside a healthy human body, none are more astonishing than pregnancy. Women's bodies undergo enormous change in the course of 9 months of pregnancy, all aimed at promoting fetal growth and development. Even more astonishing, bacteria in a pregnant woman's gut help steer the process. Deb Sloboda studies the role a woman's gut microbiome plays in healthy pregnancy. Sloboda is a professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Biomedical Sciences and an associate member of the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Pediatrics at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Can you talk about all the physiologic, summarize the physiologic changes that a woman goes through, those huge changes, and how those changes in a woman's physiology in the course of 9 months of pregnancy affect the microbiome, the gut microbiome, and how the gut microbiome, it's not just a one-way street, how the gut microbiome modulates those changes in a woman's physiology.
Yeah, thanks for that, David. The changes that a pregnant individual undergoes over the course of becoming pregnant are, as you say, quite vast. And they are amazing. Pretty much every single organ in a pregnant person's body changes. And these are all entirely normal changes. And I would say that most of them are directed to the fact that there is a growing organism, and in fact, another organ entirely, the placenta, which needs energy. And that energy has to be preferentially diverted from the maternal system to the fetal placental system. And so a lot of these changes, including changes in the glucose and insulin signaling patterns and metabolism, immune changes, changes in the obvious hormonal profile. There are changes in blood volume and blood pressure to ensure that there's adequate blood flow going to the uterus to facilitate this nutrient transfer, oxygen, and waste removal. There are changes in the ligament structure to create relaxed joints in the pelvis to ensure that we can actually deliver a very big-headed child, which is new in our species, or relatively new evolutionarily. So all of these things prepare for maximum growth and development, to ensure survival post-birth, and to ensure safe labor and delivery. So up until, you know, about 2013, so less than 10 years ago, if you asked a fetal physiologist or a perinatal physiologist, how do these changes occur? The number one answer is always, well, it's pregnancy hormones. There are hormones that we know about, estrogen and progesterone, that circulate, considered female sex hormones. But there are other hormones like placental lactogen, like prolactin, that all participate in changes in these organ systems. And that was textbook. That's exactly what I taught in my lectures. But about 10 years ago is when the notion that the microbiome and the gut itself could participate in these changes, that's when it happened. And quite frankly, we don't know much. It is an incredibly exciting area of research. It's brand new. I'm excited to be part of it because I've never been part of such a shift in scientific thought. In 2013, it came about because there is this seminal paper that was published by a group from Germany, and Ruth Lay published a paper showing that where they took the microbiome from otherwise completely normal pregnant individuals from first trimester and third trimester, and they took the stool from these pregnant individuals and they colonized germ-free mice. And germ-free mice are special mice that are raised without microbes. And scientists use these mice to understand what microbes do to the physiology of these whole body organisms, if you will. So what they did was they took these germ-free mice, they colonized them with first trimester and third trimester stool samples from pregnant women. And they saw that the mice that were colonized with first trimester stool looked pretty normal, didn't change their physiology all that much. But when they colonized the mice with third trimester stool, they saw that the mice gained weight, they gained adipose tissue, and they became relatively insulin resistant. This was truly mind-blowing. It actually showed on a more causal pathway that microbes actually participate in the processes that I've just described. And I have a principal interest in glucose and insulin metabolism and adiposity over the course of pregnancy. And so this I found fascinating. And how could this be? I even had to change my pregnancy lectures to account for the fact that now we have a brand new mechanistic signaling pathway that could participate in physiological changes over the course of pregnancy. But the black box is, we don't know how this is happening. And other than really, correlational data and the observation that there are shifts in the types and abundances of bacteria that that we find in stool samples in humans over the course of pregnancy, we really don't know much about the relationship between the pregnant individual and her gut bacteria and the impacts on her physiology, at least in humans. So what we've been doing in mouse models is trying to understand these relationships and some of the things that could be driving these changes. And we have new exciting data in the lab that was collected by Dr. Tatiana Ribeiro, who showed that the simple act of just becoming pregnant completely changed gut function in female mice. And she showed that pregnancy alters not just the gut bacteria, but gut barrier function. Normally, under normal circumstances, our gut and indeed all of the membranes that are exposed to the external environment have a barrier. We do not want external foreign bodies from entering our blood circulation. That is what the barrier is there for. The barrier is often made up of mucus and very tight opposing cells that prevent the passage of foreign bodies and indeed pathogen, so harmful bacteria, from entering and passing through these cells. And in terms of the gut, you can imagine it's not just about harmful bacteria, but we eat all sorts of things, molecules that shouldn't be passing into our circulation. But we see that just by being pregnant, at least if you're a mouse in this case, just by being pregnant, the gut becomes more permeable. And it becomes quite a bit more permeable right at a time point in mid-gestation of these mice. So it actually allows and permits things from the lumen or the outside, the environment, to pass through the maternal gut and into the bloodstream, which is totally fascinating and completely weird.
And is the idea that it's the gut microbiome, it's those bacteria in the gut that are mediating this drop in the mucosal barrier?
Yeah. So we know from non-pregnant work that bacteria and bacterial components, so pieces of the cell membrane like lipopolysaccharide, can bind to receptors on the epithelial cells of the gut and change certain proteins, tight junction proteins that adhere the cells together. And so these types, both gut bacteria and the metabolites that they produce, they participate in both maintaining and changing that gut barrier. So we are right now in the process of trying to understand how how the bacteria and their metabolites can change the barrier and barrier function. They also can change even mucus. And in fact, Ekkermansia muciniphala is a bacteria that degrades mucus. So there are certain bacteria that participate in both maintaining and degrading that barrier. We actually right now, at least during pregnancy, don't really know which one of those bacteria are participating in that process. We have some idea, or at least some hypotheses, that if bacteria themselves are not participating, meaning that the lipopolysaccharide isn't participating in the process, we think probably that it's their metabolites, so short chain fatty acids, which are the products of fiber fermentation in our gut. We know that these short chain fatty acids have a really, really important role to play in insulin secretion. There are certain cells in the gut called L cells that have short chain fatty acid receptors, and short chain fatty acids can actually stimulate these gut cells to produce a really important hormone that actually travels to the pancreas to stimulate the production and the secretion of insulin. So it seems logical that this pathway could be participating in some of the metabolic changes that we see over pregnancy, but we actually don't know anything about this over the course of pregnancy. In fact, we don't even have a lot of data on the circulating levels of this hormone. The hormone's called glucagon-like peptide 1. We know very, very little of it about pregnancy at all, even though it's got this massive role to play in pancreatic changes. And I'll just say that there are very significant pancreatic changes that we already know about that occur over the course of pregnancy, like beta cell expansion. Beta cells produce insulin because the pregnant individual becomes naturally more and more insulin resistant over the course of pregnancy, to raise blood glucose so that blood glucose can be transmitted to the fetus preferentially. More and more insulin also has to be produced to counteract this raising glucose. And so where does the insulin come from? Well, it comes from an expansion of the cells in the pancreas that produce this hormone. And we used to think it was all related to progesterone and placental lactogen, all of it. And that's exactly what I used to teach, except now we're thinking about some other things that actually might be eliciting this change. And we've not really thought about the role of the gut before.
And so you're thinking the gut microbiome, does those bacteria must play a role?
Yeah, I think they must play a role. As I said, we don't know for sure, but I think the role is likely indirect. I don't think that there's gut bacteria circulating around and getting to our pancreas, but I certainly think that gut bacteria through quite a few steps beforehand can certainly be playing a role through production of metabolites. These metabolites are signaling molecules. We know that. We know that they play a really big role in signaling a number of different really important pathways. One of them is metabolism. The other super important one is immune function, and maternal immune remodeling over the course of pregnancy is absolute key during pregnancy, because you don't want to reject a foreign body, which is the fetus, right? The embryo is a foreign body, so immune cell remodeling is also really important. And in other studies, we're looking at how the gut microbiome might participate in that immune remodeling as well.
Deb Sloboda is a professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Biomedical Sciences and an associate member of the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Pediatrics at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast. coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Join the SFU SOCA, Students of Caribbean and African Ancestry, all throughout February for events in celebration of Black History Month. On February 1st, at the sub-social stage, from 3 to 5 p.m., is the kickoff ceremony with a focus theme of African Americans and the arts. On February 9th, games and movie night in the SOCA room in the Student Union Building, room 1430, on the first floor, from 6 to 10 p.m. February 16th, get your groove on with a dance workshop held in subroom 2410, second floor of the Student Union Building, from 6 to 8 p.m. And finally, February 24th, support SOCA in recognition of 30 years with a gala event held in the sub-ballroom, fifth floor of the Student Union Building, from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. For more information, visit the SOCA Instagram at SFUSOCA or drop by their space in the Student Union Building, room 1430.
Is Bird Note. In some parts of North America, sandhill cranes are common as ants at a picnic. The largest population breeds in Canada and Alaska. Afterward, they gather in the thousands at southern wintering grounds, like this flock in New Mexico. In New England, on the other hand, they've been almost as rare as pterodactyls, until relatively recently. Small numbers of sandhill cranes now appear throughout the region. At first, birders couldn't believe their eyes. But sandhill cranes are unmistakable. They stand almost 4 feet tall, with a wingspan around 6 feet. Their plumage is gray, with a brilliant red forehead. When a sandhill crane chick hatched in Maine in 2000, it was evident the New England birds were not just strays. Cranes now breed in several parts of New England, especially Massachusetts. It's one of several areas the sandhill cranes are recolonizing after losing most of their historic wetland habitats east of the Mississippi. While many species are struggling, it's important to celebrate the successes, too. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is sponsored in memoriam of Alice Ashbaugh, a lifelong birdwatcher and amateur ornithologist.
Mm-hmm.